Alors bonjour, bienvenue à tous. Bienvenue à cette quatrième conférence du deuxième cycle de la chaire de recherche en médecine et en droit. Aujourd'hui, la conférence sera donnée par Laurie Sheramita et portera sur le sujet Patents, the Healthcare System and Benefit Sharing. La conférence aura lieu en anglais, mais la séance de questions, les gens pourront poser les questions en français ou en anglais comme ils le préfèrent. Je vais me faire un plaisir de traduire ça à Laurie. Et donc, juste un peu présenter notre conférencière. Ben, Laurie est avocate et agent de recherche au Healthline Institute de la Faculté de droit de l'Université d'Alberta. Elle est membre de Génome Prairie. Elle est aussi membre du réseau canadien des cellules souches et du Advanced Food and Material Network. Elle est aussi membre du secrétariat canadien de la biotechnologie. En plus de ses obligations de recherche, Laurie fait partie du comité d'éthique clinique de l'hôpital de l'Université d'Alberta, du Research Ethics Review Committee of the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Alberta et du Cross Cancer Institute Animal Care Committee. Elle est membre du conseil scientifique consultatif du Hereditary Breast and Ovarian Cancer Society et elle a été récemment nommée par le Conseil national des sciences en tant que membre du groupe d'experts canadiens en nanotechnologie. Donc, les gens qui sont intéressés en nanotechnologie aussi, c'est la personne à qui parler en ce moment. Alors, ben, il me fait plaisir de vous présenter Laurie Sheramita.
Thank you, Yann, for the introduction. And I must say thank you to all of you for coming to hear my talk today. It's a pleasure to be at the CRDP. I've collaborated with people here for many years, so and this is my first actual visit. Here we go. Sorry. We're good. I'd like to thank Bartha and the CRDP for inviting me to present at this lecture series. And as you see, title of my talk, Patents, Healthcare System, and Benefit Sharing. I hope I can shed some light in this topical area. I've tried to balance my talk, a little bit of basics about the patent system, and I hope that it will meet the needs of people in the audience. But if it doesn't, please note I have my email on the last slide, and anyone is welcome to contact me if you have any further questions about what I'm going to present today. So, purpose of my talk. What I hope to do is to examine the tension between patents and the healthcare system in Canada. And I'm going to look at it specifically through the lens of genetic technologies. You can probably imagine that we could do this through looking at all sorts of pharmaceutical products, but specifically genetics for the purpose of today's talk. I want to question and raise the question to you. I don't have the answer to this, but I want to look at whether the concept of benefit sharing, as is currently enunciated in the Hugo Statement on Benefit Sharing, or the Convention on Biological Diversity, or an alternative to those, is appropriate to facilitate more equitable healthcare allocation in Canada. I think it will come as no surprise to anybody here that Canadians love our healthcare system. It's a huge priority area. It's a huge priority area for politicians. Every time we have an election, we're hearing that, you know, we value this system we have. We consider timely and equal access to medically necessary healthcare as one of those rights of citizenship. It's not simply a status of privilege or wealth. But in this lovely system that we have, and in this great country, we, like all countries, face conflicting policy goals and social goals. So we have a federal government that wants to promote the biotechnology industry. And I say the federal government, but also provincial governments as well. We're promoting biotechnology as a major engine of economic growth. And on the other hand, we have a national health policy that's always seeking to constrain costs and to provide the best care possible. And so we've got this balancing game always ongoing. So looking at what is a patent, it's a state-granted monopoly that's awarded to an inventor or his assignee. So an inventor can transfer this. It lasts for a period of 20 years, typically. You can consider a patent a document. It's something that you can actually go onto the Canadian Intellectual Property website or other national websites or the European Patent Office website and print out a patent. So it's a publicly available document that reflects an inventor's rights over his or her invention. The patent itself and the whole repository of patents constitute a useful repository of publicly available information about inventions. And a patent has to be sufficiently specific so that somebody who comes to the office and is skilled in that relevant art could actually take that patent and work the invention. So there has to be enough information in a particular patent that you can do what it embodies. So what rights do patent holders have? They have a right to make, use, or sell the invention that's stated in the patent document. They also have a right to transfer those rights to others to make, use, or sell the patented invention. From the biotechnology or from the industry's perspective, and not just the biotech industry, but from industry perspective, patents are critically important. For 90% of biotech companies that have yet to bring a product to market, patent portfolios are the only assets. What a biotech company owns and markets are essentially ideas. And this continues to be true. We still have a very nascent biotechnology industry in Canada, so there's many companies that all they have to show for their efforts is the fact that they have a patent or they have a patent application pending. And this is critically important to their going forward and developing their business. And clearly, industry favors strong patent protection. And given the option of strong patent system or weakening the patent system, they're always going to argue for a stronger patent system. The perceived benefits of patents are multiple. As I've alluded to, it's an incentive for innovation, or it's thought to be. It's important in the fact that it's a public disclosure of an invention in return for a time-limited monopoly. It's incentive for others to invest money into the biotechnology industry and to other industries. It's a means to recoup R&D expenditure. So you can take your patent, you can license it in exchange for royalties, and use that money to further develop your business. Increasingly, patents are seen as a tool, as a source of revenue that universities can have. So if they can promote patenting amongst their scientists and they keep a portion of that, of the rights, they can accrue revenues as well. Importantly, in all of this, there's the commercial side of it, but a patent in essence is a tool for the translation of the science that the patent embodies to the private sector and through the private sector to society. And that's really the whole focus of what most people out there in industry are doing. They're trying hard to make products that will then be used by society. And I think most people in industry are trying very hard to make what they perceive to be socially useful products for society. So on the other side, in some instances, patents have been shown to perhaps decrease innovation, skew the research agenda, increase the cost of technologies, because you can have a monopoly pricing situation if the person if the patent holder opts. It's also seen to be a problem in that it may undermine public trust in government, industry, and academia. And we've seen through many opinion polls that public is increasingly skeptical of scientists who are associated with industry. So generally, they're very, very, very supportive and trusting in pure scientists. This is what they think. University scientists, good. Industry scientists, bad. But the reality, as anybody working in academia knows, is that there's so much crossover now, is that you can't really determine who's an industry scientist versus who's a pure academic. And many academics have commercial interests in spin-off companies. So what we don't know is what the overall impact of patents on society is. Is it positive or is it negative? And how would you measure that? And the problem that we have, the underlying problem, is that you can't just strip away the patent system and say, well, we'll test it and see. I love this cartoon. One scientist pointing out that, you know, it's an important gene because no one has a patent on it. And I think that's a very, very important message, is that patents, by virtue of tying up certain research areas, point scientists in other directions that they might not have otherwise explored. So it's that, you know, the question of, do you want to explore more the areas that are patented and lots of research is already going on, or do you want to explore something that's brand new? So I think the unexplored terrain issue and the ability of patents to direct research is something that isn't discussed enough. So, the empirical data about patents and their impact on health is an important area. I'm only going to point out to a few critical papers and a bit of data to give you a flavor for what's out there. In 1988, the paper on the top is a paper by Michael Heller and Rebecca Eisenberg on the possibility that patents could cause an anti-commons in biomedical research. And this paper came out to great acclaim. It alludes to the fact that there could be a problem created, problem of underuse of technology, when governments grant too many rights on too many upstream products, and those owners can then block downstream research. This paper has been cited from 1988 to now as a huge source of evidence that patents cause a problem. But the reality is that since then and now, other evidence has come in. So 1988 and then to 2001, Bob Cook-Deegan and Stephen McCormack published a paper in Science where they showed at that time that the trend to patent human genes was on a steep incline. And that caused a lot of consternation, and it appeared to support Heller and Eisenberg's theory that, you know, this was an area that was going to suffer a lot because of a lot of patenting. Now, this is a paper from 2005 showing what's actually happening in the U.S., and this is a paper by Lori Pressman, I believe, that the actual reality is that there was a huge increase in patenting, and this is granted patents in the U.S., by the way. So a huge increase in patents, but in 2001, the numbers have started to taper off. So although the problem looked like it was just going to keep going up, the reality is less clear. In Canada, I've drawn a graph showing patent applications in which the claims contain the term nucleic acid. So this isn't a fancy algorithm like Bob Cook-Deegan and his colleagues have used, but it shows generally the same trend. Unsurprisingly, it's, you know, we tend to get things patented in Canada to the same comparative degree as in the U.S. So this, no surprise. In 2003, Mildred Cho and colleagues published a paper in the Journal of Molecular Diagnostics. And this paper importantly looks at what the impacts of patents are on the provision of clinical testing in genetic services. The findings, quickly, the survey was done, and it was an interview surveys done on 211 laboratory directors in the U.S. 25% of them said that they'd stopped performing a particular test because of a patent or license. 12 tests were implicated with 22 relevant patents. And 15 of 22 of those patents were held by universities or research institutes. 13 of those 22 were funded by government. And generally speaking, and this was, you know, an opinion of the scientists and lab directors who were interviewed, that they had a negative perception generally about intellectual property and the impact on costs, access, and development of data tests, genetic tests, and data sharing. But what does that mean? when you've got opinion about what the impact is. And this has been a debate in the literature. Having said that, patents still cause great consternation among scientists, and recently we've been doing some survey work ourselves to see what the Canadian landscape is like. And I've just really done a preliminary look at some respondent surveys from Genome Canada and from the Stem Cell Network. And it appears that I think we'll have a generally same response, is that scientists are generally skeptical about the impact of patents. And funnily enough, at the end of the day, I'm seeing most of the scientists say, and we don't know enough about intellectual property to be making what we feel are good decisions about, you know, whether we should get patents and how we should exploit them. So there's a lot of misunderstanding and misinformation out there. This paper, Kyle Jensen and Fiona Murray, was published in Science in October 2005, and it's really a survey of what the patent landscape in human genetics is like. And what they found is that nearly 20% of the almost 24,000 human genes are claimed in a U.S. patent. 4,382 are claimed in 4,270 patents that are owned by 1,156 different assignees. 9 of 10 of the top assignees identified in this paper are U.S.-based, and the company Insight has the largest patent holdings, covering approximately 2,000 human genes. And they cited two patents. I'm just going to point out BRCA1, which is a gene for breast cancer, hereditary breast cancer predisposition. It was highlighted as being highly fragmented. So there's multiple patent owners, 12 individuals or companies for 14 patents. So this could just point to the issue that if you want to do something in the area of BRCA1 research, that you may have to talk to a whole bunch of patent holders. And the problem there is that if one patent holder says you can't use my patent, that you could be held up, and that you have to go to a whole bunch of people to talk to obtain licenses for the work. So, kind of closer to home, my colleague Timothy Caulfield at the Healthline Institute prepared a paper with colleagues who attended a workshop that Yan Zhili attended in Banff of this year, I can't remember the month.
I think it was March or
spring of this year. And what we did was we had a group of people, mostly high-profile people, come together to talk about the impact of gene patents. And we had people who were involved in this debate, so John Mertz, for instance, and Bob Cook-Deegan, and others, who we brought into a room with an individual from Myriad Genetics, for example, and kind of hashed out the issues, presented the data that exists. I think we surprised everybody a bit with the fact that there's less data than one might expect. And that data that does exist doesn't show that there's a huge problem with gene patenting. So at the end of the workshop, everybody kind of sat back and we sighed and we said, maybe this isn't such a big problem. And maybe after finding out some key information from the fellow from Myriad Genetics, maybe some of what we're talking about here is hype, and that, you know, media has had some role to play in pushing this issue to the fore. But really, that there's not kind of a systemic problem with gene patents, and that you could expect individual incidents to occur. And it may have just happened that in this case, Myriad Genetics, you know, happened early in the game, got everybody worried, and really forced us to think about what the policy options were, and perhaps even to make some bad policy decisions. But I'll talk about that. So overall, I'm still calling it the patent problem, because we've seen report after report after report come out citing that gene patents could be this huge social problem and create hurdles and roadblocks for our healthcare system. So we've seen a whole bunch of different solutions proposed in various reports from the OECD, from Canadian Biotechnology Advisory Committee and others from such extreme measures as let's ban gene patenting, let's take steps to limit the scope of gene patents, let's exempt clinical research and clinical use from infringement liability, let's give the government the authority to grant compulsory licenses rather easily in this context. We've also seen policy responses come out, which include the OECD and NIH licensing guidelines for genomic inventions, and various documents and HUGO benefit sharing statement, and in the area of non-human genetics, the Convention on Biological Diversity deals with benefit sharing specifically. But what I'd like to also mention, we've got all of these remedies to this problem. We also have in the Patent Act, as it exists, abuse provisions that permit, at 3 years post-grant of a patent, you can challenge if a patent holder is abusing his or her rights. So there's a mechanism to challenge a holder there, and there's also a provision in the Competition Act that permits a challenge as well. Having said that, you know, that patent abuse provision, you can only do it 3 years post-grant, and under the Competition Act, Section 32 has never been used. So we can't really say what would happen if challenges under that act were brought. So some clarity could be developed there. In 2005, we have the Department of Human Health, the Department of Health and Human Services in the United States published best practices for the licensing of genomic inventions. And this is a short 4-page document that gives some really concise, salient advice about what to do if you've got a genomic patent. Actually, kind of even from before that, should you get a genomic patent in the first place? And if you do get one, how should you exploit it? And what tools might you use? The OECD then came out in 2006 with an extensive document on the licensing of genetic inventions. It's long-winded, and I find it quite, frankly, incomprehensible. Having said that, I'm going to focus exclusively. The principles really embodied in the two documents are the same, but if you want to read one, read the Department of Health and Human Services document. The general principles are simple. Let's seek to maximize public benefit from government-funded research. Avoid exclusive licensing. Promote the utilization, commercialization, and public availability of the technologies. In your licensing agreements, clearly define milestones and spell out what they are, so that if you license your technology to somebody and he or she is not taking it forward, that you have the ability to say, hey, stop, license revoked, and move it on to somebody who will actually take it forward. As a patent holder, reserve rights to the invention for yourself, for the inventors, for research and development at your institution, for educational purposes, and some have even argued that, you know, for other universities to use in those ways as well. So, from the trenches, I better get hopping here. We can look at two cases that I think kind of exemplify some of the issues and that we might think about in terms of benefit sharing. First is Canavan disease, which is a U.S. Miami Children's Hospital debate that's occurred, and then Myriad Genetics in Canada. Canavan disease is a fatal disease, degenerative disease that affects children. In 1987, parents of two children with Canavan disease convinced, they went out and they found a researcher and they said, please focus on Canavan disease. We will pay you out of our foundation funds and we'll create a Canavan foundation and we'll support your research efforts. Please work on this problem. He identified in 1988 that there was an enzyme deficiency that caused the disease. In 1993, they identified the gene, and this is still while he's working with the Canavan Foundation. They identified the gene, and a patent application was filed. The trick? He didn't tell the families of these children that he was going to file a patent application. So at the end of the day, patent application matures into a fully fledged patent. And then what this researcher does is he goes ahead and he takes steps to enforce the patent against the Canavan Foundation and, you know, seeks to jack up the prices to all of the children, all the parents of the children in that particular region where there's a lot of affected children. And this created furor. But this is a simple case of a researcher behaving, I think, just clearly, very badly, unethically, not unlawfully, however. Unethically, though, clearly. Myriad Genetics is our Canadian story that we love to talk about. Patents were awarded in 2000 and 2001 on two breast cancer genes that are relevant to hereditary breast and ovarian cancer. In 2001, Myriad gets the patents, and it grants licenses to a company in Canada called MDS. So MDS decides, in its brilliance, that now it holds the rights, so it's going to take steps to enforce these patents against provincial health ministries in Canada. So I was working in an intellectual property firm at this time, and basically what happened is the Minister of Health in each of the provinces where testing was being done received a letter saying, please stop testing in all of your labs in your provinces. So there was a furor and a rush around the country to see, are we infringing Myriad's patents? So they had lawyers working away, beavering away in all of the provinces to say, yes, we're infringing these patents. So they were very broad patents covering the genes, and basically any testing methods that were being done at the time were covered by this, by these patents. So it wasn't a question of whether you're infringing or not, it's a question of, okay, we got these letters, now what do we do? So we presume the patents are valid because that's the way the law treats them, and all of the laboratories around the country are infringing. So what had happened was in this letter, Myriad said, you please send us your samples and we will charge you $3,850 per test. University labs approximated the cost, but they figured that somewhere between $1,000 and $1,500 is what the tests that they were providing were costing them. So they saw this, you know, more than double. It's huge. It's monopoly pricing. BC stopped testing, and it agreed to facilitate testing if patients wanted it through Myriad, but patients had to pay. Ontario and Alberta didn't care. Just said, we'll just keep testing. And in essence, you know, they're infringing what we presume are legally valid rights, but that's a question for another day. Quebec, however, had kind of a special inside way to deal with Myriad, and it just negotiated. Had scientists here who were involved in the development, the identification of the genes, and they struck a deal with Myriad that continues to be mutually satisfactory. Satisfaction to meet their mutual satisfaction. So, in Alberta, I'm just going to say the problem from our perspective now, and I work with a group who, a hereditary breast and ovarian cancer group. So for women in this group and for their daughters, we can't get testing anytime soon. So wait time in Alberta is over a year, typically. And the issue really is no longer about the patents. The issue now is in the provision of genetic testing services. And the reality from talking to the physicians, the geneticists in Alberta, is that there's too few genetic counselors. That's the real glitch in our system. And really, you can look at it from the other perspective too, that labs are now performing tests that they don't really need to perform. So what are our clinicians, in those labs, what are they doing performing BRCA1 and 2 testing when you can send it off? And this happens with other tests as well, that there's a commercially available alternative and why don't they use it? And, you know, if you really look at the efficiency of the system, if they would just use the commercially available tests and develop more tests in other areas, put their talents and efforts to more research. And this is one side of the coin that doesn't really get turned over too frequently. And I could talk to you more about, you know, what the geneticists say, but that's the crux of the problem in our province. Your problem is the gene which makes antibodies, but since the Biophase Corp now has a patent on the gene, I can't do anything for you. So this is really, you know, is this what's happening? Is it because of a gene that doctors are telling patients, or is it because of a gene patent that patients are telling people they can't perform tests? Future implications, quickly. The Human Genome Project is moving us to a new era of medicine. So we've gone from monogenic disorders, CF, Huntington's disease, we're moving through to complex disease, trying to figure out how human-gene interactions come together. We're seeing a blurring of the distinction between epidemiologic research, genetic research, and population genetic research. What does this mean? More complication in the whole area. Population genetic research is happening around the country in large national programs, Iceland, UK, Estonia, other countries as well. Cartagine in Quebec, Canadian Lifelong Health Initiative is a CIHR-funded initiative that we don't know where, I don't know exactly where it's going right now, but it had been along the stage of development. The United States was then also thinking about a prospective large cohort study. So all over the world, these things are happening. Pharmacogenomics is expected to, pull together information. Clinical research trials that are being done are collecting samples. Everybody's collecting samples from as many people as you can possibly get to see what your genetic profile means about how well you respond to drug treatment, whether or not you have particular propensity for side effects. So all of this information is coming together in that way. Patent sprawl. So we now know we've got patents on all of these genes out in the landscape, and now people are trying to figure out, what exact genes that you have in your whole genome are relevant to particular diseases and to drug predisposition, and everybody's trying to collect and create tests that could test you for a whole bunch of things all at once, in essence. So if that's the case, how will all of these patent rights that exist out there impact the development of these tests? Or will they? And this is an area of debate. Benefit sharing is seeming a bit tangential at this moment, but in essence, we've seen a couple of regimes set up the Convention on Biological Diversity. It's binding, but it pertains to non-human genetic materials. The Hugo Statement on Benefit Sharing from the year 2000 is non-binding, but it pertains to human materials. We're seeing from the biodiversity world, so from the Convention on Biological Diversity, where there's a regime to affect benefit sharing, that bureaucratic impediments have been constraining what people do. This editorial or correspondence suggests that this convention is actually hindering important research on conservation. So could a similar strategy hinder critical research in the human genomic area? The Hugo Statement on Benefit Sharing suggests that all humanity have access to benefits, and this is of human genomics. Everything should occur, there should be prior discussion with all groups on benefit sharing before any projects begin. Benefits are something much greater than profit simply. People should be given the ability to participate in lots of ways, and they could have people participating, you can have educational opportunities arise. And in so many more ways rather than just monetary benefit. But in this statement, they say that any entity that's using human genetics and that has obtained or used human genetic material from constituent individuals should dedicate 3% of their 1-3% of their profits to healthcare infrastructure and/or humanitarian effort. So there's this kind of, okay, now we've said everything nice, so we'll share, but the reality at the end of the day, a percentage of your profit to those of you who make money. And as I've already noted, it's very few companies, biotech companies, that are actually making any money. But this has really been seen as an issue. Having said that, what we can see from the literature right now is that there is an ethical imperative to share the benefits of population genetic research. There may be, and this is some commentators have suggested that there may be an emerging legal requirement to share the benefits and burdens of population genetic research. And my question really is, should this have relevance to other areas of research? And in conclusion, and I know this has been a quick halt through benefit sharing, but I'm out of time. Addressing the conflicts that exist between patenting and innovation policy is a critically important topical area for us to address and consider in the context of healthcare reform in this country. The trend towards patenting human gene sequences and, for instance, microarray technologies makes this an issue, perhaps, of increasing importance. Benefit sharing as a topical area, I think, has inappropriately come to be perceived and to represent wealth distribution only. And I think that that's not what the inventors of benefit sharing intended. So I would suggest that a relevant conception of benefit sharing may be envisaged as a combination of research ethics, clinical ethics, and corporate ethics coming together to define what and how should the benefits be shared between the constituent groups. I think taking, you know, from the clinical ethics world, that the principles of beneficence, non-maleficence, justice are particularly relevant to this discussion. And if you notice, there's one missing for those of you who are ethicists in the room, and that's autonomy. And autonomy has been seen as a critically important principle coming down the path since the Second World War, but it's really been a topic of increasing contentiousness in this particular area. So I think when I'm talking benefit sharing, I want to highlight those, but I think you should keep in the back of your mind, what do we do about autonomy and how does it fit? I also want you to keep in mind that patenting isn't just in the domain of human genetics. So we've seen an evolution of this discussion into other new emerging technological areas, including nanotechnology. So have we focused overly hard on genetic technologies? Is this something that's just really a broader issue that needs to be conceived of in the context of science and innovation and healthcare more broadly? I'd like to leave with this quotation. I think it's fabulous. It's from Lawrence Lessig's book, The Future of Ideas. "We've invented the technology to eliminate scarcity, but we're deliberately throwing it away to those who profit from scarcity. I think we should embrace the era of plenty and to work out how to mutually live in it." Thank you. And sorry for going over time, yeah?
That's fine, Lori. That was really an interesting talk. I especially like the discussion on the empirical evidence around the patent system. I think it was long overdue, and it was really a good meeting that we had in Banff with Kim Caulfield and all the team. Anybody, si les gens ont des questions pour Lori, vous pouvez les poser. Si c'est en français, il n'y a pas de problème, je vais faire la traduction en anglais. Oui?
Hi, I'm actually a professor at the Faculty of Law here in intellectual property. I was quite interested in your talk. The only thing I just wanted to point out is that there's some discussion needs to be made in all this in the financial clout that quite often the parent company of the biotech companies that are doing the, yes, it's true that the poor little biotech companies that are startups may not be really making any money, but quite often there's somebody above that has quite a lot of financial clout, and that gets lost sometimes in that whole thing.
And your point is very well taken, and that's something that I couldn't really go down the path, but pharmacogenomics is clearly, that's at issue, it's at play. And I'm seeing it in the clinical ethics committees that I'm seeing you sitting on. So we will definitely be looking at that.
I had a question for you, actually, yes. Laurie. I was wondering if the picture that we are seeing right now concerning biotechnology and the patent system, now that you're really working into the field of nanotechnology, do you see a similar picture or do you see things differently now?
Well, I think, interestingly, when I started off in this field, I came to the Faculty of Law thinking pretty much that industry was bad and that public health care was good and that, you know, patents had to be bad. And so my thinking about this whole topical area has come around a lot. I don't think that patents are inherently bad. I do think that the problems that we're seeing here, and I think I at least alluded to it, that I don't think this is specific to genetic technologies. I think it's something that's much broader than that. But I think, like in genetic technologies, we see that if there is incentive for individuals and firms to make money, that there is incentive to work around these patent issues. And if there's money to be had, people have an impetus to enter into a license agreement. So if we can just put into their minds that licensing is critical, and licensing is really where it's at, and licensing is where the problems will fall out, I think with all technologies, that we will have made some headway here.
Do you think the CBAC report was interesting on licensing, the last one? It's been critiqued a lot.
But to be honest, Jan, I read it when it came out, and I haven't looked at it since.
Okay.
If you want to elaborate and...
No, it's just that one of the recommendations was actually on licensing guideline, on using good licensing practices and things like that. So, I mean, I think people are coming around to realize how important licensing is.
The only thing that I fear is that we have... genetic exceptionalism, I think, has gone awry, and those licensing guidelines that we see from the OECD and from the NIH, I think they're ridiculous to just focus on genomic inventions, and I think that it's an over-attention to that particular area when it's an issue that cross-cuts all innovation.
C'est les deux dernières questions qu'on va prendre. Alexandra, comment?
Did you have a chance to look at the impact of the opposition process that exists in Europe based on morality or public interest?
I haven't. I haven't. It's been on the topic for a to-do, and there's a whole bunch of research sitting in a pile that I was supposed to be writing a paper with a colleague in Montreal, and it's not done yet.
Okay.
So I can't really comment, but a fellow right behind you might be able to comment on that.
And that same fellow, Brittany,
the question.
I was wondering if you could comment a little bit on how the different actors involved in this patent landscape view the patents. I'm thinking in particular of, you know, commercial biotech vision of patents investors versus universities and university researchers, and the type of conflicts that arise when there are different visions of what a patent's for, what are the benefits that come out of that patent, how it should be translated.
Well, I think what we've seen in Canada, at least, that you've got a conception that patents are important. I think that maybe the reason that they're important is viewed differently from industry to academia. Academics want to put the patent application on their tenure application. They want to show every year that they've been on a patent. And not necessarily because they care about how they're going to exploit the patent. Industry, on the other hand, cares about the patent as a potential source of funds and as a tool for leveraging additional funds. I think there's been a problem within universities as to how do you deal with this? Now we've got this impetus to patent, and they've got technology transfer offices that are working feverishly to file application after application without carefully considering the merit of filing that application or not. I think there's a real lack of understanding by a lot of people in these offices. It's improving. But I think that's been like a critical issue that we haven't explored as much as we perhaps could and should. I've seen, for instance, I mentioned that we would like to retain license rights to the inventor over his invention. And I've had a situation where a colleague patented a lovely chemical entity and proceeded to then license it to another colleague. It wasn't being used, so the inventor said, hey, I want to get that back. Colleague, now ex-friend, says no, because it was just a matter of they needed to hold on to it so that someone else couldn't do something that was going to be competitive. And this is friends working in a university. And the problem underlying this was the Technology Transfer Office didn't think, you know, it's conflicted, and it didn't prepare a good agreement that could protect the inventor. So there's a whole bunch of things like that happening at the practical level.
Okay, thank you very much, Laurie. That was a really good presentation. And so this was the last conference before the holiday break. And when we're going to be going back, the first presentation will be on February the 14th. Je m'excuse, je continue dans la tendance anglaise de la journée. Et ça va être le professeur Alan Torstendottir d'Islande qui est présentement au Joint Center for Bioethics à Toronto, qui va venir nous entretenir de Genomics, a Global Public Good. Donc ça devrait être très intéressant. J'espère que vous y serez tous. Et puis bon repas.